With us now is Martin Duberman, Distinguished Professor of History Emeritus at City University of New York, where he founded and directed the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies. He is the author of dozens of award-winning histories, biographies, memoirs, essays, plays, and novels, including books on Paul Robeson, Stonewall, Howard Zinn, and Haymarket. And he's the author of an important new book, Has the Gay Movement Failed?, that we want to discuss today. Thanks so much for joining us on KABU, Martin Duberman.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You have been a radical activist and writing about the political left and gay rights movement for decades. What prompted you to write, Has the Gay Movement Failed?
My discontent with the direction of the movement has been mounting really for quite some time. I was active in the early 70s in the post-Stonewall period when the contemporary gay movement as we know it began to develop. And I was far more sympathetic then to the agenda of the movement than I am currently, because I feel that the radical critique that represented the early movement, the lack of single-issue politics, and instead a broad assault on racism, sexism, and classism, I think that's been gradually fading over the years. And in the last 15 or 20 years, as exemplified by the Human Rights Campaign, which is now the largest LGBTQ organization with an annual budget of many millions, that organization and the current agenda of the gay movement was for 20 years, roughly, confined primarily to the two issues of serving openly in the military, and winning the right formally to marry, neither of which objectives have I ever been in great sympathy with. And I think it's, well, alas, I feel that those issues do, however, represent what the majority of LGBT people have wanted over the last 20 years. I mean, that leads into huge, you know, questions and statements. For example, is it impossible for a radical movement to maintain its momentum? Is it always the case throughout our history that the kind of passionate intensity of the early days of a movement inevitably, quote-unquote, give way to a kind of assimilationist agenda?
And of course, you've been studying social justice and radical movements for your entire career, so I can understand why you might lean towards concluding that. But what was it about the gay liberation front that offered so much more transformative possibilities than the more recent LGBTQ movements have done?
I think the whole climate of the day, the national climate, which would include, you know, the second half of the 60s and the first few years of the 70s, it was a national mood that encouraged experimentation, encouraged directly facing the assorted atrocities that characterize our economic and social structure. What in part accounts for the change after the early 70s is, I think, a whole host of economic shifts which saw our economy faltering, threw many people out of work, led to the decline of industrialization and unionization. The whole bloom was off the rose, as it were. This wasn't any longer a society of endless expectations in which we could push forward the frontiers in all directions. It became instead a society focused on, you know, securing a daily livelihood. And that deepened and worsened throughout the 70s and led in 1980, of course, to the election of Ronald Reagan.
Well, you also write that the post-1980s LGBTQ movement has moved away from the kind of inclusiveness and really intersectionality that the Gay Liberation Front offered in the early 70s in challenging gender roles and concepts of love and sexuality and issues of imperialism and race and social justice, and that this post-1980s movement has really been focusing on inclusiveness in the body politic through marriage or rights to join the military, has really lost sight of that more radical restructuring of society, has it not?
Yes, this whole notion of being included in the body politic, I think, involves deep unconscious deception on the part of LGBT people. We are not just folks. We have had a different historical experience. We have been outsiders for a very long time, and as a result, we've formed different perspectives. Those differences are now being denied across the board in order to persuade mainstream America that we are just folks and therefore are entitled to all of our civil rights. And what I also think is involved there is what I just said earlier, namely that this is a process that, in my reading anyway, the majority of gay people themselves do embrace. Life is hard. We want to be accepted by our neighbors. We want to be seen as just folks with the same aspirations and goals and emotions and so forth. It's a very, very understandable phenomenon, given how limited and difficult our lives are, that we don't want to constantly be fighting battles based especially on how different we are how different our perspectives are. So if my reading is accurate, I understand the wish and the need to feel accepted. It seems to me a very human need, but alas, at the same time, it runs counter to any campaign for significant social renovation.
Well, your book is also important, I think, for its critique of the left as well, for failing time and time again to embrace the queer potential for social transformation. As you just noted, LGBTQ movements should not claim that they're just like everyone else in order to emphasize the transformative possibilities of LGBTQ activism and the redistribution of power, et cetera.
Yes, I think this whole notion that we really are just mainstreamers, in a sense, has played into the hands of what we need to call, I guess, the straight left, which is silly, but I don't know how else to characterize it. The non-gay left might sound slightly better, because they want to believe that we have nothing to tell them about their lives, not simply about who we are, but who they might be if only they opened their ears and paid attention to what we have experienced and what we are now willing to share about our understanding of gender, for example, our understanding of sexual monogamy and so forth, of family, of friendship. I mean, there's a whole litany here of possibilities. But I've read widely in the non-gay left literature that is emerging, and I read Jacobin, which is currently, you know, the chic new journal that represents the non-gay left, and you not only don't you hear much, if anything, about gay people and what they might have to tell us, but you also don't hear much about feminism.
Mm-hmm.
which in part may be a comment on the current state of the feminist movement as well. But I think the non-gay left, as it's currently manifesting itself in the new generation, is primarily, like the old left of the 1930s, is primarily concerned with economic issues, with classism, and also, to be fair, with racism. It's less concerned with sexism and with sexual orientation.
And challenging the gender binary.
Yes. I mean, someone, in fact, who interviewed me recently, who will be nameless, but who told me that she did write an article on transgenderism for Jacobin, but had a somewhat difficult time with the people there, because apparently isn't clear to them how much transgenderism has to tell all of us about the mutability of gender, you know, and the nonsense of the old binary, which insists that men and women innately, genetically, have different characteristics and therefore are destined for different social roles.
Mm-hmm.
I think that view remains widely held in the populace at large, and I don't see the non-gay left doing much to dispel it.
And Martin Duberman, we just have a few minutes, but just as the straight left or non-gay left has ignored issues of gender and sexuality and LGBTQ issues, how has the LGBTQ movements ignored Black, brown, and working class LGBTQ people? It seems to me that's another important part of your book, that as there has become wider acceptance of LGBTQ people, the actual lives of Black, brown, and working class LGBTQ people have declined in recent decades.
I think that's absolutely right, and somewhat disgraceful in terms certainly of our large national organizations. They're becoming somewhat more conscious, but primarily to date they've been operating in the name of the agenda put forward by primarily white, male, middle and upper class men. Oh, I said men. And, you know, the vast majority of gay people are, in fact, do not fit those categories. They are working class people. The gay movement, even in its earliest days, when it was at its most radical, there was a great deal of struggle within GLF and GAA, the two then current organizations, over issues relating to race and class, and also in regard to gender. Finally, a lot of the women in GLF gave up on their male brothers because they found the sexism so deeply ingrained, even in gay men who claim to be across-the-board radicals.
Martin Duberman, we thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO. And we want to encourage people to read your book, Has the Gay Movement Failed?
Thanks very much.